everyone. Welcome to the Racing Writers Podcast. I'm your host, Kelly Crandall. Thank you for clicking on this episode, and I think you're really going to enjoy it, as Tommy Joseph, the aerodynamic supervisor at Ford Performance, is our guest. Tommy, as I said, works for Ford Performance. He's been in that position since 2017, and if you're curious what an aerodynamic supervisor does, it's one of the things we're going to learn today, as Tommy takes us inside the Ford Tech Center in Concord, North Carolina. That tech center has a lot going on, not just NASCAR, but everything that Ford touches comes out of there. Tommy takes us on that journey and explains his role, as well as being involved in the design process of the next-gen vehicle and the way in which he got to be involved and get his hands on that. Thought it was really interesting, that information, talking about the blank sheet of paper you have and the things you want to incorporate that just might not be feasible or viable, and how everybody worked together across all of the OEMs, and Tommy getting to work across the table to his fellow peers. His background is really interesting, though. As I said, he's been with Ford since 2017, but through the early 2000s, for 12 years, Tommy was involved in Formula One. He worked for some really great teams, recognizable names like Red Bull, Williams, and Honda. So we go into, of course, the culture difference between the Formula One world and the NASCAR world, as well as just different engineering approaches from the two series. And again, Tommy's a great guy to really dig into the science of racing with. And I have to admit, I don't know if I really understood everything he was talking about because I'm not a technical person, but I really enjoy getting to interact with Tommy or anybody on this side of the sport, and certainly the folks at Ford. And as I mentioned, that Ford Tech Center in Concord is a just fascinating and really cool place. So I thought it'd be great to kind of bring that insight into the podcast. And I hope you really find it enjoying and educational, because I certainly did. So here is Tommy Joseph on the Racing Writers Podcast. Here I am. Well, I appreciate you doing this. Very much looking forward to it, mostly because I think your title just speaks importance. I mean, obviously, it's good to see you again, by the way, Tommy. I know who you are. We've interacted before, but aerodynamic supervisor for Ford Performance. Let's start by you just giving everybody kind of an overview of what that means and what you've been handling this past year.
Yeah, well, it is a fun title for sure. I enjoy my role very much. We have Ford Motor Company, a huge company with 200,000 people in a lot of different countries. Our biggest market, of course, is North America. And we do a lot of things, but what I like the most is motorsports. So we've got a motorsports group, and they've got a management structure with different supervisors for different disciplines, like aerodynamics, powertrain, vehicle dynamics. And for each one of those, they would manage our motorsports activities globally. So I will be involved in aerodynamics in NASCAR, Australia Supercar, the World Rally Championship. Wherever we decide to race, now or the future, we get to get involved. And we also have counterparts that manage the program side. So guys that are not attached to a discipline, but people that are follow a series like NASCAR or Australian Supercar. And we have to work with them. They know what's best for the series. We know what we should do in terms of the best practice for aerodynamics. And we work together to get race wins and technology transfer to the greater company.
What's the easiest way to tell race fans what it is you do? Obviously, when they hear aerodynamics, they know what that is. It's very important when it comes to racing. But to hone in on what you're doing at the Ford Tech Center, what's the easiest way to tell folks what you're looking at, what you're doing?
Yeah, I'd say race fans are definitely very smart in terms of the technology and what makes a car go fast. So they know terms like wind tunnels. A lot of them know what CFD is, which is computational fluid dynamics. Those are our two main tools. The wind tunnel, for people who don't watch racing, I would say just imagine a big fan and imagine the conveyor belt that you've got at your grocery store that you put your groceries on, except it's going at 175 miles an hour. And that's what you've got for a wind tunnel. And it's a big laboratory that we measure things in. Computational fluid dynamics is a virtual version of that, where we're solving equations and dividing the air up into small pockets, small cells that we can solve one by one to arrive at a big solution. And that can be, you know, 50 or 100 or more million cells that encompass the air around one car. And we simulate and calculate and predict what might happen to the airflow around the car, and try to change things to make the performance better. And again, most race fans know a lot about tires and how they work. The more you load them with downforce, the faster the car goes because the tire gets grip. And NASCAR specifically is interesting because you only turn left. The car side force comes into play because of the high speeds and the turning in one direction. So we look at aerodynamic side force as well to improve performance. And then, of course, on drag, I think there's also good understanding there that, especially in Daytona, which is one of the fastest race events in any series, the main performance factor there is to reduce drag, make the car as slippery as possible, make sure the driver can go full throttle all the way around at the maximum speed.
You hit on it that wherever Ford is racing, you're working on stuff. And that's important to note because that Ford Tech Center, there's a lot that goes on there. It's not just NASCAR. It's everything that Ford is involved in. There's work being done in that building for those series.
Yeah, exactly. Certainly NASCAR is our biggest motorsport. And I think a lot of that drove the location. And you've got a lot of the wind tunnels we use for any series are in that area in North Carolina. So that's very important to us to be close to those race teams and close to those wind tunnels. But on top of that, we're able to have a global reach with that capacity. So we've got work in there. We might have a rally car in that building, and we might be doing a test at the local wind tunnel with that. We have a driving simulator that we use for all series that have that level of support. We'll have the drivers flying from Europe. They could be driving down from Mooresville. It doesn't matter. They can use that simulator as long as we've got the right model for that car. So there's a lot of good technology there that what's good about most of it, it doesn't matter what series we're in. Those methods apply to almost everything we do, as long as it's a race car. The targets are always a little bit different, but the tools we've got in that tech center can apply to anywhere we race for the most part.
You mentioned a model of the race car, and that's one of the things that always fascinates me whenever I get to come visit you guys is those scales of the cars. Some of them, whether it, I think is one of them in clay or there's other one. It's fascinating to me. They're not full scale, obviously, but they're pretty unique scale race cars that you guys can work on and figure out what you need to do just by, again, it might be a table sized race car and you guys are able to work on something like that.
Yeah, that's something we believe in as a major tool for aerodynamics is scale model testing. And we do a lot of testing with the full size car too, but scale models are definitely a part of it. And what's good about aerodynamics for the most part, when you're under subsonic or when you're in the subsonic range with Reynolds number similarity, if you've got a smaller size car, you can get results that apply to a bigger one. So that's the whole philosophy behind scale model testing. And once you reduce the size of the vehicle, you've got cost savings in terms of moving less air, lowering the fan volume and size and speed. The overall size of the wind tunnel can be smaller. So there's a lot of cost savings there. And the parts that you make are smaller as well. So for sure, they're not like I love the Lionel models, but they are, you know, not engineering tools. I've got a few on my desk, but they are serious laboratory experimental devices. And there's a lot of detail and work that go into that. We've got a great team at the tech center to build and design those models. And they're very precise in their work. And they can execute it to a high degree of quality. And we can get really good engineering experiments done and get answers that affect everything we do in racing, from the design of the car, the body shape, to even things like the race car setup.
Again, it's very impressive. Very, very impressive how detailed things like that can be. And you keep saying the word wind tunnel. I'm curious, Tommy, obviously teams are now limited on wind tunnel time as far as the amount of time and hours they can go to a wind tunnel. Does that have any impact on how important you all have become when it comes to what you can do at the Ford Tech Center?
Yeah, I think it's something you've seen in other series too, that as costs go up in racing, people look for ways to keep it under control. And so it's not a surprise that it was done on some level. I think with the limit on wind tunnel time, you do have to be more precise and efficient with your methods. And I would say those ideas can come from anywhere. They can come from our race team partners. They can come from us. And collectively, we've had good ideas on how to make a limited amount of wind tunnel time useful. And a lot of it's just about being more efficient, getting more out of every data point, spending less time with setup and the preparation of the test and more time running through parts and getting data. So it's something that was always there. Even with unlimited time, you've got limited residents inside the wind tunnel. There's only so many hours in the day, and we always wanted quick results. But I think the wind tunnel limits have just accelerated that drive for efficiency. And we found some good steps, but I think it's something that's never ended. You're always trying to make that as quick as possible and as high quality as possible.
One of the other things that has stood out, of course, is that with next gen coming, we hear teams constantly talking about the parts freeze that happened in 2020, 2021, can't develop parts and pieces. So if the teams are handcuffed, so to speak, in that regard, for you all as the OEM, what have you been working on? What has the Ford folks, everybody at that tech center, what have you been working on, or what are, in what ways have you been trying to help the teams if there's only certain things that they can do?
I think it's correct that because things are being frozen and development and rules are more restrictive, the sandbox they get to play in is smaller. But if you start in the beginning of the next gen, so early 2019, there was a lot of basic work to do in laying out a new generation of car. And it wasn't just aerodynamics, it was powertrain and vehicle dynamics and all the areas. But I can tell you from the start, aerodynamically, just laying out what that car looked like, the greenhouse, if you look at it from the side, is different than the current Gen 6 car. The symmetric tail on the next gen, it was asymmetric and angled to the right on the Gen 6 car. A lot of those changes were long discussions between the OEMs and NASCAR. And we consulted with our studio, the guys that have the artistic eye and the style to understand how we want to represent our production cars on the racetrack. They fed in a lot of that from what they wanted. We looked at it from an engineering aerodynamics point of view. And they sound simple, but it takes a lot of discussion and agreement and sometimes disagreement to get to a good place. But in the end, everybody was happy with those results of what we call the common elements of the NASCAR Next Gen, the greenhouse, the tail, the borders of the car, what shape those should be. But it takes time to work on that. And then from there, we had to develop our OEM body, our Ford Mustang, to fit within those rules. And that took a lot of engineering work to get the lift and drag within the limits specified by NASCAR. There were requirements for radiator cooling, for the new exit that's coming out of the hood. It was a unique design challenge. And there were more restrictions placed on the wind tunnel test where we had to pass and get our car approved. So that was the bulk of our work. And through doing all that, we had to understand a car that nobody's built and nobody's raced. So we had to use a lot of our simulation tools and other tools that we have to try to predict something that was just virtual and try to design a car around it. So that was the bulk of our work. I think now that the car is designed, and everybody would have seen that in May when they got revealed to the public, it is a different phase now, and we'll just have to find it within that smaller sandbox, find places to work. And I think that's where the work is now, understanding this new car, understanding what's a performance differentiator. It's going to be very different to everybody. That's part of the fun, but also part of the challenge. I mean, you could come in understanding Gen 6 aerodynamics really well and not know where to start on this car. So everyone's got to be open-minded, smart enough to come up with new ideas and understand what are the good ideas and what are not the good ideas.
As someone who works with aerodynamics, as an engineer, as someone who likes math and science and all of that, when NASCAR and all these OEMs and teams get together and say, okay, we're building a brand new race car, and we're talking brand new. Everything's brand new, but the steering wheel, right? Is that a thrill for someone like you when you get to be involved in something starting from scratch? Obviously, it's a challenge, but is there any part of it where a project like that is also exciting to be a part of?
Oh, yeah. I think it's exciting, especially those generational changes, because you start from scratch and you don't even know what the chassis looks like or the body. All those restrictions or ideas that you might have had within a certain generation, suddenly everything's up for reconsideration, down to the wheel size. Like, we've been running with smaller wheels and we're going to 18-inch wheels now for next gen. That was a big feedback from our artistic studio group. All the changes I mentioned on making the greenhouse more coupe-like to match our Mustang more, that was important to us, but we could never do it. When we were designing the Gen 6 car, the studio would always say that this car looks great out of what we could change, but the greenhouse is just too sedan-like. So it's really good to open up those things and then completely new areas on the NASCAR Next Gen that didn't even exist on Gen 6, like the standard underbody. So understanding how to design a splitter, flat floor, and diffuser for that type of car was something different and unique, and there was a lot of work to get that working right. And yeah, I think that was all exciting. Of course, as an engineer's mind always goes beyond what's financially viable or what might work for the sport. So I think we had big ideas and then had to make them more realistic as we had various other design targets from other groups.
Right. That makes sense. I mean, you always want to go with what you think you want to do, or you have ideas. And then, as you said, you got to be realistic because people are going to go, wait a minute, we can't spend that much money. But it's fun to dream, right? And when you have a blank slate of paper, it's fun to dream of what you could come up with.
Yeah, exactly. So those are fun times. And it was great to bounce ideas off of my counterpart at the other car manufacturers and with the NASCAR sanctioning body. And in the end, within the all the restrictions, I think we came up with a good set of products.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I'm excited to see it on track. And of course, everybody has high hopes for it. And speaking of next gen, I would think that, again, with a brand new race car and in the position that you're in, where the OEM and again, that Ford Tech Center is going to play a big role. And as everybody learns this car, again, it's going to be a learning process. Next gen is going to be something that will keep you always learning in this job, right?
Yeah. And I think there's always learnings when you're racing the same rules, but there's a bigger set of unknowns when the generation changes. And that I think there's going to be big low hanging fruit to pick very early on. And that it's a race to see who gets that. And then as rules stabilize and they're consistent over years, things tend to converge, which is another exciting time in a different way. So instead of finding a couple of big ideas that are going to be found out by your competitors a little bit later, you're looking at smaller, maybe a million little finer developments that aren't so obvious that you improve over the race weekends.
So Tommy, I want to back up a little bit because I've read a little bit about you. I want to get to know you, of course, even more because I'm fascinated by your background because you have an F1 background and you've got to see that part of motorsports, which is all about, as we know, engineering and information and so many great drivers all across the world. And now, of course, you're in NASCAR. So I want to get to know you just a little bit better and kind of fill in some blanks here. And I've read where you were into sports when you were younger, but you knew you weren't going to make it, say, to the NBA. You liked basketball. You went to Clemson and studied mechanical engineering. But I'm curious, when did racing, when was that something that sort of started to enter your mind? When did car racing and again, aerodynamics and all of that, when did that become something you wanted to pursue?
I would say that aerodynamics came before cars and racing, and sports came before cars and racing. And with aerodynamics, it was more fighter planes. I remember having kind of baseball cards, but not for baseball, for different Air Force and Navy planes. So that was my set of baseball cards when I was young. And I would say I got into cars separately, but more street cars like Ferraris, Lamborghinis. I had those posters later on. But aerodynamics was actually first. And I remember in fifth grade doing a science project for aerodynamics, like a demonstration with a model F-16 up on a pedestal. So it was always something I was interested in from a flight perspective, not so much cars. I became interested in cars separately. And even when I was 16, I would work at a small drag racing shop outside of Chicago and went to the drag strip and we sold Go Fast performance parts and things like that. But in those days, I was more interested in the engine than aerodynamics. And it wasn't until I was following this random racing on TV. I would watch drag racing. I would watch NASCAR. I would watch Champ Car. And it was when Alex Zanardi went to F1. I was watching him in Champ Car, and I was really thrilled by his driving, his pass at the Corkscrew in Laguna Seca. So when he went to F1, I watched it a little bit. I didn't really stick with it. But then when Juan Pablo Montoya left Champ Car to F1, I started watching more intensely and then stuck with it. And as I started watching F1, as I was moved on to Clemson and got involved in Formula SAE, did some work there on the engine, which was really fun. I just felt like I'd seen on TV as a spectator how important aerodynamics is in Formula 1 and Champ Car. I had not studied it intensely other than basic fluid dynamics classes at Clemson. And then I think that's when I took the step of combining racing and aerodynamics and wanted to study further aerodynamics.
But how does one get their foot in the door at F1? Because you go over to Europe, you start working in F1, you spent 12 years over there with some very recognizable teams. How do you go from the United States to getting your foot in the door in Europe to eventually, again, start working in F1?
Yeah, I'd say a couple of things that I learned along the way, and I always pass on to anybody who's asking, that from a technical engineering perspective, the U.S. has really, really good schools, aeronautical engineering. And the difference in going to do an advanced degree in the UK, like I did, is not so much that you're getting a better education, but you are going places where you can network and meet the right people to get into F1. So the education is good there as well, but I wouldn't say it will stand out better or different. And a lot of aeronautical engineering is driven by defense spending. And of course, in America, that's been always been high. And we've always produced a lot of the best aeronautical engineering examples, especially in military flight. But England's probably number two there, and they've done a lot of it too. So the unique thing about Southampton University, where I did my master's degree, was they had one of the best wind tunnels in the late 70s, 80s. And when everybody in Formula One realized aerodynamics was important, they didn't have wind tunnels at the time at the team headquarters. So they would go to Southampton University with their scale models and go test there. And it got so busy that they got pretty concerned about IP transferring from one to the other. And certainly they had money in those days to go build their own wind tunnel, that everybody did that. So the legacy is that that Southampton wind tunnel and that aerodynamics group had a lot of specific experience in ground vehicle aerodynamics, and even more specific on open wheel and Formula One vehicles. So I would say it's not a question of the education or training there being better, but you're just in a more specific area and you're able to network and meet people. And because I was there and at Southampton, I ended up emailing Willem Towett at what was then British American Racing Honda, the team that's now Mercedes, asking for a dissertation project. And then he gave me a project that involved designing that Formula One car for a land speed record. And I would not have made those connections if I did not know those professors at that university. And I know people who have done it another way, by just going to university in the US and then trying to get a job in Europe, but it's not as easy.
Goodness. Oh my goodness. Engineering in F1 versus engineering in NASCAR. Is there a way to break it down? What's the difference?
I'd say the design targets of the car for sure are different. The racetracks are very different and the car is very different. So the two things that really determine what you would design are quite different. So for example, in a Formula One car, the slowest corner, if I remember, it's definitely the Monaco hairpin. The speed was something like 60 kilometers per hour. So, you know, 30 or 40 miles an hour, not very fast at all. And the fastest corner was probably turn three in Barcelona, or one of the turns in Silverstone, which is maybe 250 kph, which is about 180, 190 miles an hour. And NASCAR ovals, especially the intermediates with all the banking, you kind of only have that high speed corner and you're only going left and there's banking and the car's three or four times as heavy. And the tires are different. And of course, the biggest difference for an aerodynamicist, you don't have all the wings. You've got to do it with the body shape and the spoiler. So while the tools you might use are the same in general, you know, the wind tunnels were similar, the CFD was similar, there might be differences in how much you got to use them or how much you spent on them. The design targets are different and the thinking is different. But no matter which series you're in, you've always got to be adaptable and open to rules changes if you're going to be there a long time. Because again, as soon as the generation changes or even a rules change, like I remember in F1, we went from 2008 rules to 2009 rules where they widened the front wing and narrowed the rear wing. You had to think differently. The aerodynamics became very different. We saw the same thing in NASCAR with the 2019 rules with the bigger rear spoiler and the bigger splitter and the full throttle racing. You had to think differently. Your targets changed. And on top of that, I would say that certainly the resources, the rules are enforced differently. So in F1, I would say it was more of people had a good understanding of the rules, but they were less likely to try to get away with something or push the limits without having a lot of communication with the sanctioning body. In NASCAR, it seems like everybody comes in with something that they're trying to get away with sometimes, and sometimes they get away with it and sometimes they get caught. There's a lot of cultural and historical precedent between the way the series are run that affect how you might design something. So, and that's interesting to see those differences.
You said in a piece I read from Ford Performance that the start of your end in F1 was that the learning curve plateaued. And again, you like to be challenged. You like to keep learning something. So eventually, again, after 12 years, you're done in F1. How did you get to Ford? How did you come back to the States? And then you've been working for Ford since 2017. Kind of just fill in the gaps for me there.
Yeah, well, I was looking around at jobs in the US. I actually had a former classmate from Clemson that was working for Ford at the time. So he let me know about the open position for aerodynamic supervisor. So that's how I found out about it. And then I applied and interviewed and got the job. So it was really something that stood out to me out of all the options about what I wanted the most, because it was global. It was with a big OEM that's been around for over 100 years and has been respected in racing in multiple series. The position allowed me to get involved in a lot of different things, and I felt like I could use my experience in three or four aspects of aerodynamics that I moved around in Formula One. They had all of those on some level for me to get involved with and use and improve. So I think it spoke to me both on a company reputation and history, the specific position allowing me to do interesting things, and also me being able to bring a lot to them. So I wanted to be useful to them and help them grow and improve. And when we hit on all those points, it just became the best choice.
When you say that, again, the learning curve in F1 had plateaued, was that just because it got to the point where the rules weren't changing that much and there really wasn't anything you can really dig into?
I would say it's a little bit of that, but every time someone says that in the past, I've been in F1 for, I think it was 12 or 13 years total. Every time we're sitting in the office and there's no crazy ideas coming out and somebody says, oh, the rules have plateaued, that's when somebody comes up with the F-duct or the blown exhaust or the double diffuser. So I never say that because I know something's going to happen. I think it was more, I mean, F1 was great and it's a really good training ground for engineers, but I think they have some things to work on diversity, equity, and inclusion. And the way to move up in F1 isn't always a meritocracy. I think there's a lot of politics, a lot of bias at the high levels. And I think if you look at teams, a lot of teams now are doing things to fix that, which are good, but I don't think that was always the case. And certainly while I was there, it wasn't the case. So I think in reality, it was a mix of different things and it's a good place to be, but I think it was a little bit of me having the skills I needed to go further, but I felt like there was a ceiling there and I saw it. And it's good to see now that I think people are recognizing things and fixing it. And I hope things like the Hamilton Foundation and other actions they're taking will help. But for me, that was a big part of the plateau, was that I had capabilities to use, but I couldn't get the position to really deploy my skills and make them known.
Right. I want to squeeze in a few more things here. You go from F1, which is, I guess you'd say, very fancy. Once again, all over the world, some of the best drivers in the world, some amazing racetracks, and you come to stock cars and, you know, we're a hamburger and hot dog crowd and drink beer. What was that culture shock like coming to stock cars?
Well, I have to say that I guess being at Clemson, I was born and raised just outside of Chicago. Clemson was my first real experience outside of that. And going to Formula One for sure was equally foreign, and Europe in general. You know, part of my experience there was not just the work life in F1, but just living in Europe, living in England and Switzerland. And what I would say from those three or four cultures that I've experienced is that everywhere there's a difference, and it's good to see differences because that's how I learn and kind of respect and take the best from all cultures. And there's never been one where I said, oh, everything's perfect and everything's great and I like everything. And there's never been one where I said, there's nothing to learn here, nothing good. And I like being used to different environments and adapting where I can. And I'd say as an engineer, you're a little bit removed from some of the things you see on TV. Certainly in F1, I see the driver spraying champagne and the paddock club, you know, people drinking fine wine and things like that. And the parties at Monaco. But a lot of my memories were working late on a Friday night or on a Thursday night, preparing for Friday practice. And I remember Monday, we were in Shanghai leaving for Bahrain, I think it was. And I had a choice, either tour Shanghai all day Monday or work on our aero data for the next race. And I ended up, you know, winning was important to me. So I stayed in the hotel room, worked on that data for the next race, and then left China without seeing anything about Shanghai. And then coming back to NASCAR again, it was familiar. It's different in an interesting way. I think if you look closely, you can find similarities. People who like winning and competition. You've got some extremely competitive people in both Formula One and NASCAR. And it's really, I'm one of those. And I also believe in sportsmanship and, you know, being a good competitor. And I like meeting those kinds of people and I've met them on both sides. And that's a commonality. And again, in NASCAR, I'm kind of separated from some of the things you might see at the racetrack because a lot of our work is done in the wind tunnel and in front of our computers. I did go to a lot of races when I first started to understand the sport, but I didn't do the whole calendar. And our best work is going to the racetrack to understand and then going back to our computers and wind tunnels to try to make the best design. But certainly, different. And I think it presents a lot of interesting mix of cultures and personalities that I like to get into and understand and talk with.
Yeah. All right. Two more things for you, Tommy. What's the difference between someone who likes cars and likes the car culture and someone who likes competition?
Well, I think you have a lot of each of those and they're different. Whereas, especially when I was a teenager working at a little speed shop in Chicago, we had people come in for wheels because they wanted their car to look good. And if you extend that to something like the Pebble Beach Concours or an event like that with show cars, to me, that's interesting, but it's not, I wouldn't say it's my passion. It's more of an art of maybe a nostalgia. Another example is the Goodwood Revival that they have in England, where they race or display classic cars and everybody gets dressed up in an old-timey way. That's interesting for me to look at, but I've never actually gone there. And for someone who's a competitor, I think it really is about the sport. And, you know, while every sport, every professional sport, of course, is a business as well, I think most people who are in it really want to challenge themselves and they want to compete and win at a high level. And I think that thinking is similar whether you play basketball or soccer or football, or if you're in racing. And for me, part of the reason I liked Formula One and one of the things I made sure of before I joined Ford was that I wanted engineering to matter, for engineering to be a performance differentiator. So I knew I had an influence. And so I knew I was doing something that was important to getting that result. And I always felt like that, both in Formula One and all the race series we're racing now at Ford, that we are doing things that make a difference, that lead to wins. Ford has a lot of other goals besides winning, but winning is the number one goal in whatever series we're in. So for me, it's a very big difference in mentality. And I don't have a classic car in my garage or even a anything fancy. I drive a Bronco Sport, which is nice, but it's nothing you would ever put in a car show. But I do like to compete through the race series that we race in.
Yeah, I think you touched on it. It's about mentality. So that's a good segue into the final thing I wanted to ask, which is, I guess it would be about mentality, but what makes a good engineer, or in your case, a good aerodynamics supervisor?
Oh, good question. I'll grade myself here. So I would say I'll answer both, because, you know, we're always looking for good engineers. And the thing about racing is that if you want to win, finding a good engineer isn't enough. You need to find the best. And you could say everybody I've met in racing is good and there's a lot of talent out there. But when you put up 40 talented race car teams against each other, there's only going to be one winner. So it's important for us to find the best. So I would say a good educational background is important, and you can get that in different ways. But for aerodynamics, there's a lot of complex science. The equation for turbulence is the final unsolved mathematical problem in classical physics. It's very difficult to solve that equation and understand it, which is part of the reason we use computers to do it for us. But even then, there's a lot of understanding there. For racing and motorsports, we do have specialists that get into research and development details, but we also have guys that are generalists that need to see the big picture. So it's important for someone to know which one of those they're in. And we do have a lot of different tools. Like I mentioned, computational fluid dynamics and the wind tunnel, they're both very different and they have strengths and weaknesses. And an engineer needs to take information from all of those, put it together and synthesize it and decide on the best course of action. You can't just turn the crank on a tool and expect it to spit out the right answer. It's always going to be a little bit wrong. And somebody has to use their human creative brain to take all that information and come up with the right answer. And equally important to all those technical skills, you have to be someone that can work in a team, especially since we're in a team sport. Aerodynamics cannot exist by itself. You've got to understand the tires and vehicle dynamics and the powertrain, and you've got to be able to talk and work with these other groups efficiently and quickly to get the right solution. And people like a technical director on the race team will have a little bit of a view of everything, and we've got to get the right feedback from them. So that's what I think makes a good engineer. For a great aero supervisor, I would say it's important to have done those things in the past, but then trust your team to do it well, give them the information they need. And we've got a great team of aerodynamicists right now that a lot of them have been around for the entire almost 5 years that I've been here. Some of them are new and doing really well. So I try to guide them like a coach. And they say that management styles, you know, 50 years ago were more generals, dictators, but now I prefer to be a coach. And I think the modern young engineer, that's what they want. They don't want someone to tell them what they do. They want someone to guide them. So that's what I try to do and not try to make all the decisions. I try to leave the decisions to them. When they ask me for help, I'll guide them and just give suggestions rather than ultimatums. And I think that's a good way not only to get a good result in the moment, but that really develops good engineers and leaders in the future. And of course, what I do for them is I speak to all our program supervisors in NASCAR or the World Rally Championship or my boss, the global director, and get from them what we need to succeed in these programs. So I just try to set up the playing field so these guys can succeed. But when you see our cars, like the next gen NASCAR Mustang or the new rally car, the new supercar, these are all the product of the team, the guys on the front line and the working level. And all I do is give them the tools and facilitate that kind of development so they can do the job themselves.
Sounds good. Tommy, a lot of what you do is over my head, but I will say that I appreciate you and all of your colleagues at Ford Performance in that tech center, because whenever myself or you have media over there, you guys do a great job of trying to educate us. So I thank you for that and doing more of that today on the podcast. So thanks for the time.
Thank you. And you're always welcome at the tech center or the racetrack or wherever we are. Maybe even come by the wind tunnel one day.
Absolutely. I would love it. Thank you, Tommy.
Thank you.
My thanks to Tommy for coming on the podcast. Once again, let me extend that to him. And again, just being able to go to the Ford Tech Center when anybody over there opens it up and welcomes media for an event or to show us things such as taking us and walking us through NextGen and some of the differences and the parts and pieces, that car really is fascinating. And it's going to be a lot of fun to dig into over the next couple years, certainly in 2022 as we put that car on track. So I appreciate Tommy, again, not only welcoming myself or any of my colleagues to the Ford Tech Center, but coming on the podcast and helping us just understand a little bit more of what he does. At least I hope we understand it, right? Man. There is so much that goes into building these race cars and the engineering, and there's so much that goes on away from the racetrack that we just don't see, that it's really cool and really fascinating to try to understand it and listen to it. And I really enjoyed Tommy being on the podcast, and even when I edited this episode back, just listening again and trying to educate myself and understand what it is that he does and how it affects racing. And I like the fact that Tommy wants engineering and he wants his job to matter. He wants the aerodynamics to matter. That's really, really cool. So thank you again to Tommy, and thank you to Dan Zacharias from Ford for helping coordinate and make this interview happen. Of course, thank you for clicking and listening along this week. I hope you enjoyed the episode. I hope you've been catching up on episodes, going through the archives as we roll here through the off season, giving you your racing fix as we wait for cars to be back on the track. Please leave a rating and review if you haven't done so, or if you would like to do so again, I greatly appreciate that. Hit the subscribe button so that a new episode will be in your podcast feed every Monday morning. You can also reach out to me on social media. My Twitter handle is at Kelly Crandall, and my name is everywhere across all platforms. There's no fancy handles, so if you want to find me on Instagram, you can do that at Kelly Crandall. And on Facebook, make sure you're looking for the public Facebook page, which is where you will find links to the podcast as well as links for racer.com. And make sure you've booked racer.com, because not just for content throughout the year, but content through this off season if you're looking for news and other quirky items, as I said, to get us through the winter. One last thing before I let you go for this week, please check out Patreon. That is another way to support me, support the podcast, and maybe just get some additional content for the podcast if you're really enjoying it. It goes a long way in helping me on an everyday basis and helps put the podcast together. So patreon.com/Kelly Crandall. The show description also has the link for that page if you want to. Please check it out. Next week, we are getting back on track. No pun intended, but we're going to go back to racing in the sense of what a team and drivers are doing, because we're going to have a 2-for-1 episode next week. BJ McLeod and Matt Tift are the guests. I talked to them separately, very busy men, so couldn't get them together, but talked to them separately. Going to put it all in one episode for you as we reflect on the first year of Live Fast Motorsports in the NASCAR Cup Series. So BJ can talk about it from a driver's perspective, from a team owner perspective, while Matt is going to walk us through what it's like to be a Cup Series owner, but a former driver that's now watching a car that he owns on the racetrack. So a lot of fun with those two gentlemen. They are always great to interact with. And that will be next week right here on the Racing Writers Podcast.